Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest information on the likelihood that the Russian airliner that crashed in the Sinai was brought down by a bomb planted by agents of the Islamic State. David Glebe, a chief investigator for aviation safety investigations in the UK, joins us to discuss how the investigation is being carried out and whether objective forensic evidence will come to light, given that confirmation of a terrorist bomb will embarrass the Egyptians over their lax security and will be seen in Russia as blowback from Putin's intervention in Syria. Then we will speak with a columnist and senior diplomatic correspondent for the London-based Al Hayat, the leading Arab daily, Rahida Degam, who is also the founder and executive chair of the Beirut Institute, an independent think tank for the Arab region. We'll discuss her article at the Huffington Post, Moscow Needs an Exit Strategy for its Syria Quagmire, and whether Putin can satisfy both Iran, which wants to keep the Assads in power, and the wary Sunni world that the Russian leader's recent diplomatic initiative has brought to the table with the Iranians in an effort that the US appears to be going along with. Then finally, we'll discuss what appears to be the meltdown of Dr. Ben Carson, who is the leading Republican candidate in Iowa and is close behind Donald Trump in the national polls. Anthea Butler, a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right, joins us. We'll discuss whether the candidate is running a fraudulent campaign, selling his books while selling himself for president, and how long Dr. Carson will remain the darling of the religious right as more and more of what he has written about himself in his bestsellers is being exposed as fiction, while he blames the press for checking the facts. And joining us now is David Glebe, who is the chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group in Loughborough University in the UK. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Glebe.
Hello. Nice to be with you again.
And David, you've just returned from a conference in Doha on aviation safety. And I imagine being in the region, a lot of talk probably around the edges of the conference was about what's happening with the investigation into the Russian airliner that crashed in the Sinai. At this point, it looks pretty likely that the Islamic State managed to have a bomb planted aboard the plane. So in terms of what I mentioned in the opening, are you confident that if that is so, then the forensic evidence from a bomb blast will eventually come to light?
I think the forensic evidence from a bomb blast will always come to light, but it will just take time. There's been plenty of people pretending to be unofficial, making a sort of side comment to the press or making press announcements for their own purposes and things like that for their own political pressures. At the moment, we're getting the wreckage recovered out of the Sinai Desert over to Cairo. There will be some what we call witness marks on the airframe itself. However, these may have actually been destroyed in the impact or not become obvious until literally the wreckage is lifted out of the sand. So the metallic evidence will take time. And in general, when you send a team of experts off to an accident investigation site, they are what you would regard as civilians. They are engineers and pilots with a great degree of background knowledge. They're not necessarily bomb experts. So if you did suspect that it was a bomb that brought down the aeroplane, then you'd have to call in specialists from outside the accident investigation agencies, say from the FBI or something like that, if it occurred in the United States, to help you diagnose what had actually gone on. So you don't just look for evidence in the metal. And we've heard that there is some form of loud noise just before the cockpit voice recorder finishes its recording. But you'd be looking for evidence in amongst the baggage of shrapnel. You'd be looking for evidence in the bodies of the deceased for shrapnel as well during the pathological examinations. And you'd be looking for some form of chemical residue as well in order to be able to help the analysts carry out their searches.
But already the bodies have gone to Moscow. Some have been buried. The pilot's been buried. Obviously, the questions are, as I mentioned in the opening, that the Egyptians may not want to be exposed for their lack of security at Sharm el-Sheikh Airport, and they certainly don't want to discourage tourists from coming to Egypt because they depend heavily upon the tourist economy. And of course, Vladimir Putin doesn't want the Russian people at this point, even though he has suspended flights and subsequently sent a lot of Russian planes in to pick up the people. He suspended flights, but Russian media is still reporting that it was an accident, not that it was a bomb. So you could see why some people are concerned that there may be an effort to sweep this under the rug.
Yes, certainly. And as I say, there's a lot of different things. The airline put out a press statement very early on saying it was an external cause and it couldn't possibly be their fault. That may be factually correct. On the other hand, it may be sort of early public relations saying, stock exchange, please don't, you know, let our share price crash or have some, you know, financial and reputational management issues there. So we realistically have to wait a period of time. But we have some countries represented that you would respect for their independence. So the aircraft was actually registered in Ireland, which is very common for leased aircraft in Russia. You have the United States maybe participating in relation to the engine manufacturer. You have the French as the airframe designer and state of manufacture as well. So you have a degree of independence amongst the investigation team. So if they disagree with the findings, they can also put this in an appendix. But it's fairly hard to hide bomb damage for an aircraft of this type. Certainly the aircraft manufacturer would not want the entire Airbus fleet grounded that was more than 15 years old because of metal fatigue. So very much a question of, well, was it one of the other possible causes of the tail unit falling off? So there's very strong interest to make sure that it would be published as the truthful result these days.
And again, I'm speaking with David Glebe, who's Chief Investigator for Aviation Safety Investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK. So the fact that the British came out very quickly or sooner than anybody else, certainly, with the suggestion that it was a bomb that caused this crash, and this was after the US satellite information came out that there was a flash detected over the Sinai. Of course, having the British Foreign Minister basically agree with the British intelligence and release this information, which apparently came from intercepts, this was highly embarrassing to General Sisi, Egypt's leader, who was actually on a state visit to the UK at the very time that this news came out. And that was, of course, he was trying to repair his international image following the military coup in Egypt. So the British seem to have stuck their neck out.
Yes, certainly there have been comments from within the industry that the British Prime Minister, when he made his announcements later on, certainly wasn't sticking with protocol. Whereby you let the investigator in charge release the information to the public at a press conference, or you release it to the relatives first of all, and then you tell the press afterwards in terms of family assistance support, which is the standard way of doing things according to the International Civil Aviation Organization. In terms of whether he was suddenly saying, I'm going to ban all flights into Sharm el-Sheikh in order to protect British citizens, because obviously British citizens, some form of protection. If he said later on, oh yes, we had the intelligence to say that it was a bomb, but I still let British citizens go on holiday there, and there was another tragedy afterwards, then he'd be held to account for that. So it's a bit difficult to get the balance right for why a country not involved in the accident, so that again was the Irish and the Russians and the French and the Egyptians, as well as the citizens of Russia and Ukraine. So why would another country suddenly get involved and say we're not flying there anymore without a degree of criticism from the public saying you've cancelled my holiday? So I can see it both ways. It was a break with protocol. It was unusual. Whether the information that was intercepted by the British will really come to light. It declares a level of intelligence capability. I'm quite surprised that it was released in quite such a way. But on the other hand, if the Prime Minister thinks it's right to protect British citizens to stop the flights, then that's quite appropriate. So it's definitely a break with protocol and, indeed, during a state visit, quite contentious.
Well, apparently this information, this intelligence information, was shared with the Russians, and that led Vladimir Putin to suspend flights. That, of course, embarrassed the Egyptian authorities further. They're not very happy about it, although the chief Egyptian investigator did hold a press conference where he announced the cockpit flight recorders. The last thing on it was what sounded like a noise. He didn't say it was an explosion. So it seems as if they're sort of gradually getting to that. What's your understanding in terms of the aviation world's understanding of security at the Sharm el-Sheikh airport in the Sinai Peninsula?
I mean, in general, Egyptian security at some airports is very good. You do have some privately run airports, and I went through one of them a few years ago and was very impressed that it was all done to full international standards and everything like that. And at other airports, it's a little more relaxed, should we say. You see people not going through full security checks that you would have with the TSA in the United States and things like that. And there are many points where you can, many different groups of people touch an aeroplane during the servicing. And it's not just putting a bomb into a passenger's luggage or having a suicide bomber manage to get through. It's all those people who do the physical turnaround of the aeroplane and push the tractors around. It's the people who put the steps up to the aeroplane, the people who load the baggage containers or put the bags on board by hand, the caterers, the people who put the water on board and take the sewage away, the cabin cleaners. There's all sorts of opportunities to get through the security system, and I have to say that certainly the reputation has not been fantastic, and the people that I'm in contact with out in that area of the Gulf do seem to think that it's quite lax, certainly by what you'd regard as North European and North American standards.
But at the conference that you just got back from in Doha, in the Gulf, what was the chatter then about the since you were with a group of experts on aviation safety and investigations of crashes, did the chatter kind of come to a consensus that this was likely a bomb and likely the work of the Islamic State?
Just one factual correction. It was actually Dubai, but the chat amongst all the accident investigators, because we're all professional and we know how long it takes to sort this type of thing out, was, well, we'll know in time. Various things that are not reported in the media, like there's a sandstorm out there at the moment, which makes actually seeing the wreckage very, very difficult, or moving it and getting access. It obviously, if you move the sand around, it starts to cover up small objects in the sand that you need to recover and things like that. So everybody was very broad-minded in that it could have been anything. Nothing had been ruled out whilst I was there, and nothing had been ruled in. And I got back a couple of days ago. So at the time, it was all let the due process go through. If anybody needs any help, they can always call some of the other countries if necessary to provide technical assistance. And also, part of the focus was on a discussion in relation to an Antonov that crashed actually during the conference as a freighter and passenger aeroplane in South Sudan. So that almost took some of the heat off the Egyptian discussions.
But the fact that all the bodies have gone back to Russia and probably been buried by now, is that a problem? That if there is shrapnel in the bodies, that won't be a part of the investigation?
I would have expected that there would be a degree of pathological examination of the bodies. Either if the Egyptians released them to the Russians, then they would have informed the Russian representative that no pathological examination being carried out. Could they carry that out in Russia? Have they got more pathologists that are free at the moment and things like that? So they may have offered to repatriate the bodies and undertake the examination there, or alternatively, it may not have been done at all. It's more usual to carry this out if you suspect that there's been a bomb in a cabin. because obviously where the bomb detonates, then you're very likely to get shrapnel into passengers sitting next to the bomb and things like that, and you can work out where the likely origin of the bomb was from where they were sitting on the aeroplane. So whether this has been carried out or not, we don't know. It could be upsetting to the relatives to know these things as well. So at this stage, how much information has been gathered from the aviation pathologists and standard pathologists and fed into the investigation, it's still at the confidential stage and could be quite upsetting to the relatives unless they're briefed first before the media.
So just in closing, David Glebe, what's your sense of what is the likely cause of this crash?
Certainly when you get indications from different directions, from intelligence agencies, and now we have the cockpit voice recorder, then it's certainly highly indicative. But only when we have the full forensic evidence would we normally declare at that point that it was definitely a bomb. And wreckage recovery from the desert is not easy, particularly as the area is still subject to some level of terrorist activity and insurgents in that area. So I would imagine within a week to a month, then all the parties would agree that all of the evidence points to one conclusive point.
Well, David Glebe, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Glebe, who's the Chief Investigator for Aviation Safety Investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK. We're going to take a brief station break and be back discussing Russia's recent diplomatic initiative to bring about an end to the civil war in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rahida Degam, who's a columnist and senior diplomatic correspondent for the London-based Al Hayat, the leading independent Arab daily, where she writes a regular weekly strategic column on international political affairs. And she's the founder and executive chair of the Beirut Institute, an independent think tank for the Arab region. She has an article at the Huffington Post, Moscow Needs an Exit Strategy for its Syria Quagmire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rahida Degam.
Thank you very much for having me.
And let's talk about the quid pro quo here, if there is indeed one, in terms of what went on in Vienna, where the Russians convened a meeting at which the foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia faced each other somewhat sullenly across the table. Apparently, it was a difficult meeting. But in your article, the Huffington Post, you suggest that the quid pro quo is that the Russians have sort of agreed not to create any difficulties for the Saudis in Yemen in exchange for their cooperation, given that essentially Russia's come to the rescue of Iran's proxy, if you will, Syria. So what's the extent of that? Because my understanding is that the Saudi intervention in Yemen could be in itself a quagmire, as Syria clearly is.
Yeah, well, the Saudis are in Yemen under the umbrella of the coalition, the Arab coalition, led by Saudi Arabia, and they are fighting the Houthis and the remnants of the former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. And Iran is said to be backing the Houthis in a very serious way, creating trouble for Saudi Arabia right at its borders. So for Saudi Arabia and its allies, it's a matter, Yemen is a national security matter. It's not simply a proxy war. So if Russia, and I know that for a fact from my Russian sources, Russia understood that it is a big deal for Saudi Arabia that Russia does not obstruct the efforts of the envoy, the UN envoy regarding Yemen, or Russia is not openly critical of the coalition's operation in Yemen. And my sources tell me that, yes, indeed, Russia agreed to play what I call the Chinese way in Yemen, which is they would not obstruct, they would not interfere, they would not make a big deal, they would not scrutinize. And therefore, that would be satisfactory to Saudi Arabia, that itself also would like to have an exit strategy from Yemen, having been there for a while and knowing the cost of further, you know, sort of like military operations in Yemen. So, yes, indeed, Russia decided that that's how they would pay back to Saudi Arabia and the concessions that the Saudis have made in Syria.
So we know that Putin sort of got his ducks in a row before the Vienna talks. Assad went to Moscow. The Russians met with the Saudis, and they also, of course, have close relations with Iran and with Iraq, by the way, which the U.S. has spent so much lives and treasures on, and yet they have no traction, it appears, when it comes to getting any concessions out of the government of Iraq. So how much do you think the apparent bombing of the Russian plane over the Sinai, has that affected this calculus?
So let's back up a little bit, because the deputy crown prince of Saudi Arabia went ahead with a visit to Russia even after the Russian military intervention in Syria, and that meant a lot for the Russians. So this was part of understanding and how to build on that Saudi-Russian relationship and taking it to a further use, given that many concessions were made by Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, and as well as by Turkey. And the impression is that what Vladimir Putin would have said to Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, when he visited Moscow, is basically either, don't worry, we're going to back you till the end, or, well, get ready, because you're not going to be staying there forever, and the best way is to have an honorable exit than a forced one. We will not know clearly for sure, but the different vibes coming from the different talks tell us the following, that everybody agrees now to the realistic fact that Bashar al-Assad is here at the beginning of any political process. The question is, what happens at the end of the process? The Russians say, I can't give you guarantees. And the Saudis say, but I need to know the end game if I'm going to go along with you. The Iranians say, well, nothing really. They do not want to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. He's their ally, and there is a bit of a difference between the Iranian and the Russian positions. This is important. Why is that important? It's because it looks that it is about the Assad knot, K-N-O-T, the Assad knot, that's the only knot that's the problem in the whole thing. It's not so. That is a very important problem. But the other one is about the withdrawal of the forces, be it Russian or Iranian forces with their allies, Hezbollah, from Syria. That's number one. Number three would be the problem. How do you define and who is on the same page when you define who are the opposition to deal with in Syria and who are the terrorist organizations? And number four, and that is very interesting, that Russia decided to spearhead the fight against ISIS or ISIL or Daesh. And in that, it's looking as if it is aligning itself with whoever is allied with her, and including Iran and Hezbollah and the Shiite militias. And that really sets, if you will, it sets up Russia in a very fragile and in a very sort of targeted position. I mean by that, if it's true that ISIS or others have been behind the bombing of the plane, then this is a big signal. It is saying that you cannot go ahead and become the country that is spearheading the fight against us while aligning yourself with the Shiite militias. And therefore, it's a big quagmire for Russia. And Russia's explanation is that they say that we have our minority inside Russia is Sunni, and the five Islamic or Muslim states around Russia are Sunni, when in fact this is a reason why Russia should be more careful not to provoke the Sunni anger while it's obsessing about ISIS. Yes, it needs the Sunnis as a partner to defeat ISIS, and that is the most important problem that must be resolved for Russia, not to appear as if it is going into an anti-Sunni démarche.
And again, I'm speaking with Rahida Degam, who's a columnist and senior diplomatic correspondent for the London-based Al Hayat, the leading independent Arab daily, where she writes a regular weekly strategic column on international political affairs. She's the founder and executive chair of the Beirut Institute, an independent think tank for the Arab region. Well, clearly, when Russia first stepped into Syria and President Obama at a White House press conference was sort of challenged by the press, you know, Russia, Putin is being manly and bold and you're being kind of feckless and uncertain. And Obama strenuously objected and more or less said, look, you know, to Putin, well, welcome to our quagmire. So what is it that the president thinks he knows about the notion that Russia is going to crash and burn?
The president of the United States is probably saying to the president of Russia, yes, go right ahead and spearhead the fight against ISIS. It's fine by me. ISIS is the common enemy of Russia and the United States and even for the Gulf states. It's an existential threat to the Gulf states as well. So, yes, we can collaborate, all of us, and we can work, all of us, to defeat and obliterate ISIS and its likes. But then there are some understandings that should be, political understandings that should be clear to all. Maybe the president of the United States does not really care much about the fate of Bashar al-Assad himself or whether the Iranians pull out 100% or not from Syria. But his allies in the Arab region do care very much, and they're not going to extend any help or in a serious way, unless they get assurances to that effect. Now, if the Russians do not see this point and they decide, I mean, you know, sometimes Vladimir Putin is accused of acting in a very arrogant way, in an adventurous way, and to the extent that we hear some people say that some in his own military apparatus is very afraid that he would be venturing into Syria in a way that would remind the Russians of what the Soviets did in Afghanistan. And that's why we hear the word Afghanistan, the Afghanistan quagmire. So it's up to him. And President Putin is probably saying, let's work it together if we can. And if you're going to do it alone, well, welcome to your own quagmire in Syria. The trouble is that all of this is at a cost for the Syrian people. So it is really not a very noble thing to say, take your time and let's see how much can you sink, because it's already 300,000 people dead later. And yes, there is a lot of criticism of President Obama for having not stepped in into the Syrian situation before the growth of the ISIS of the world and their likes. Yes, I mean, no one is innocent of what happened in Syria, but the measures are applied to the extent of who got very involved and who didn't decide, who decided not to get involved at all. That's probably the word you were looking for when President Obama, in the view of many, turned his back on the Syrian people and on the opposition, which is now they're trying to rehabilitate to see if that is going to be part of the way out.
Well, do you think, though, that now that it appears that Daesh, the Islamic State, are behind the bombing of the Russian airliner over the Sinai, because it's pretty clear that when Russia initially started bombing, they started to bomb basically the militias that were close to Latakia and Damascus, the ones that were lobbing shells into the Russian embassy in Damascus. They went after them first, and some of them are allied with the U.S. The U.S. accused Russia of basically leaving the Islamic State alone. Since the Sinai incident, Russia appears to have targeted ISIS. So do you think that, when you say that the U.S. and Russia may well be now starting to target ISIS more, but that Russia has to be aware of blowback in the Sunni world, what are the Sunni states that are stepping up to give Russia cover in terms of going after ISIS?
Well, all of them. The Gulf states, first of all, are part of the alliance, the coalition led by the United States against ISIS in Iraq, right? So we established that as a fact. And they are willing, they have given many concessions, including not only the Arab states, even to a great extent, there is a big change in Turkey's position. So, but let me focus on the Gulf states. They are saying to Russia, we are with you. We will work with you. We want to get rid of them. The point is that we can't be partners, they're saying, with Russia while we are getting rid of ISIS in a way that is going to secure Bashar al-Assad's continuous domination in Syria and that he would remain in power. That's number one. And we cannot do that when it looks like it's giving the upper hand for Iran and its militias, Shiite militias, and Hezbollah in Syria. They cannot do both. And that's why the Gulf states are telling the Russians, work with us. We want to be able to be part of this coalition against ISIS in Syria. And the boots on the ground for that battle, if you will, they are not. And the boots on the ground for that matter, it's not going to be American boots on the ground, not necessarily Russian boots on the ground. It would be the Syrian opposition. The Syrian opposition that Russia would, in that scenario, have not targeted, but embraced. That is the way to defeat ISIS. Not by allying yourself with the enemy or whatever marriage of convenience it can be, and say, come with me and we'll talk about it later. Come with me now and we'll decide the future of Bashar al-Assad later. Come with me now without talking about the withdrawal of Iran from Syria and its militias and Hezbollah. They cannot do that, the Gulf states. They are unable to do that, to deliver. That's why Russians really need to wake up and be very, very careful about what they're doing. Generally speaking, Vladimir Putin is looking very much on top of the game. He's looking like he's victorious. He's looking like everybody else is bowing to his fait accompli. And that is true to a large extent. But beware what's behind. Beware that, you know, overconfidence sometimes produces many difficulties. And in this case, these are disastrous difficulties. So we don't know what the Russian people are going to do in case it's proven that ISIS really went after the innocent Russians on aboard the plane. I think they may turn to Putin and say, wait a minute, let's remember Afghanistan. Let's remember that this could be a quagmire. Or they could just say to him, listen, we buy what you're telling us. We need to get them over there before they get us over here. And this would remind you, Ian, probably of what former President George W. Bush said when he was asked about the war in Iraq. He said it's about getting the terrorists over there so that they don't come to our American cities. So probably Putin is doing a George W. Bush example, trying to fight the extremist terrorists in Syrian land with Syrian lives, rather than having to face them inside his own country. So in that case, he may convince his people that's what he's doing, but it also could be that it could produce the counter result, and the Russians would say, no, we don't believe in that, because we are digging ourselves into a very dangerous quagmire.
Well, just in closing, Rohit Dugam, assuming that Russia is able to ease Assad out, and as you pointed out, it'll be harder for the Iranians to make some kind of deal that gets rid of him without guarantees about the future of Hezbollah. But at the end of the day, most analysts that I've spoken to suggest that there will have to be a second Syrian war, and that will be the war to destroy Daesh, the Islamic State.
It's taking place. This war is taking place now and should take place now. No one is saying let's not have this war right now. But the difficulty here is to get all the partners to be able to deliver on this war against Daesh, ISIS. You need the partners on the ground. The opposition, the Syrian opposition, is willing to even partner. But they want to know that they're not doing that in order to uphold Bashar al-Assad in power and to enhance the Iranian military presence in Syria, or to give a win to Hezbollah. I mean, it's only logical.
Right, so right. But surely,
on the ground.
But surely, though, Rahida, it will require enormous deployment of boots on the ground to secure a kind of peace, assuming you can get rid of the Islamic State. Which of the Arab neighbors are going to be willing to deploy an Islamic
State? I heard recently, Prince Turki Faisal, saying here in New York on the last week, I heard him twice saying that, so I know I heard him correctly. He was saying that in case that is all clarified, even the Saudi Arabia would be willing to provide boots on the ground and would influence other countries to do so. So that is what I heard him say. Is this an open policy by the government of Saudi Arabia? I need to check that. But I think he wouldn't have said that twice in New York had this not been made clear by Riyadh. So I think, yes, there will be willingness to come in and fight ISIS. Because I assure you, ISIS is a very dangerous, it poses an existentialist danger to Saudi Arabia. I mean, they want to establish a state instead of that state. They want the holy places in Saudi Arabia above all. And so, yes, it is in the interest of the Gulf to find ISIS, to fight them wherever, whether in Iraq, whether in Syria. The problem is in Syria right now, again, it goes back to what we've been discussing, you and I. Is it only about the man Bashar al-Assad? It's definitely one big element, of course, but it's also about the Iranian presence and role in Syria. And mind you, by the way, I just want to say one last thing, Ian, if you permit me. There is an impression, and I think it is correct, that the U.S. has offered Russia the leadership in Syria. And because, you know, this administration, because the American people do not want to get involved in Syria, and therefore, you know, no problem, as we already discussed, the president of the United States said to Vladimir Putin, be my guest, you go ahead and do it. Good luck if you succeed, and it's your quagmire if you fail. But on the other hand, You would have, the issue of Iran. Any Iranian military presence outside the Iranian territories is in contradiction and in direct defiance of a Chapter 7 resolution of the Security Council of the United Nations, which prohibits Iran from being present either directly through its own forces or advisors or proxies, or giving military aid to anywhere outside their territories. But no one, not the United States, not Russia, not anybody, brings this up. Why? It was because the supremacy of the Iranian deal was put above everything else, and no one wanted to shake that situation, that status. And now that we have the deal, maybe it's time to think, to say to Iran, yes, you are in defiance of Chapter 7 resolution of the United Nations, and use that as part of the pressure needed to be put on Iran to stop interfering so very badly in Syria. And let everyone have that fight against ISIS together and hopefully defeat them big time.
Well, Rahida Gama, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rahida Degam, who's a columnist and senior diplomatic correspondent for the London-based Al Hayat, the leading independent Arab daily, where she writes a regular weekly strategic column on international political affairs. She is the founder and executive chair of the Beirut Institute, an independent think tank for the Arab region. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing what appears to be the meltdown of Dr. Ben Carson. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her most recent book, Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. Professor Butler's latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthea Butler.
Thank you. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Anthea. And I'm watching or witnessing the meltdown of Dr. Ben Carson. I don't know whether you saw the press conference the other day where he was asked to defend himself vis-a-vis his claims of having been offered a scholarship to West Point when no such thing happens. You don't get scholarships to West Point, and met with Westmoreland, which he apparently didn't, and wouldn't mention who the person was that he said he stabbed, and mercifully the knife hit the buckle on this person's belt, and thus he ended his rage. Or came to deal with his rage. And then there are the Wall Street Journal is revealing a whole bunch of other inconsistencies, if not untruths. I was most struck, I don't know whether you saw the press conference, but I was most struck by his persona and his demeanor, that he just seemed to be losing it because he simply cannot deal with criticism.
Yeah, it was kind of breathtaking, actually, to see. I think that maybe we're actually really seeing part of Ben Carson, that that's the real Ben Carson, maybe. And what I mean by that is that he's not used to being challenged. And I think that, you know, a lot of times, especially for people who are in a position like being a really high-powered surgeon, you're not used to having people ask you questions. You're not used to being, you know, challenged on anything. The operating room is your place, right? And I think that Carson has operated this way for a long time. And I think now that the pressure is on, he's proving that he might not be the candidate that people seem to think that he is.
Well, in New York Magazine, Jonathan Chait has an article, Is Ben Carson Running for President? ? And he basically makes a case that maybe this entire presidential race and is fraudulent, in as much as it's very unusual for a candidate running for president to take time off in the middle of a campaign to sell books. And Chait saying that this is basically a brand building exercise that's going on, and he points out that Carson is spending an astronomical 69% of his fundraising for the presidential campaign on spending it on more fundraising, whereas Bernie Sanders, by contrast, spends just 4% of his intake on further fundraising, and that the person who's running Carson's campaign, Armstrong Williams, a well-known African-American conservative, he calls himself not the campaign manager but the business manager. So, is it possible that this is just simply, we know that some of these candidates are basically promoting themselves and trying to bring themselves out from the kind of wilderness like Santorum and Huckabee and others, and Huckabee's got a book as well. But this seems to be taking it a lot further. So what's your sense of whether or not essentially this whole exercise is fraudulent?
It could very well be, but let me say this. In Ben Carson's defense, although I hate to be the person who started defending him, you know, he was out there before. He had a lot of name recognition because of his books, especially with evangelical Christians and African-American Christians. His books in the 90s felt great. He ended up having lots of people, you know, follow him. It was amazing, actually. So if he's using it for this purpose, it's not surprising because, like you say, Huckabee, Santorum, lots of other candidates have done it. But I think in this particular case, what is very interesting is that so much of the money is going towards, you know, promoting things and then also the books as well. So, yeah, to take 2 weeks off to sell your book is kind of a little bit surprising if you're really serious about running for president.
Well, his ties to Manitech, which is this medical supplement operation that he helped sell an awful lot of their product on Christian television, and he's clearly been shilling for them, even though he denied it. Barefaced, he in the presidential the last presidential debate, he said it was propaganda. But the facts are clearly indicate that he took an active role, presumably got paid a lot of money, and as a doctor was pushing something that was pretty dodgy. So again, I'm trying to get a sense of this mixture of God and mammon. And I'm trying to understand why this fellow is so popular with the religious right, even though every day we find out that most of his bio is starting to look pretty questionable.
Oh, well, you know, I'm going to take you a little bit back and refer you back to one of my favorite characters in American literature and film, Elmer Gantry. He was what he did, right? Mm-hmm. Up in Sinclair New. And there's lots of figures like this that have appeared in evangelicalism. And I think, you know, for these religious right people who really like Carson, it's not the lies so much. It's the belief that he brings the kind of morality they want. And so they're willing to overlook these other things. And when you hear him say, you know, the media is attacking me, all of that stuff, that is a defense. I think the other thing, too, which is really important, is that you have to sort of get a sense of what the worldview is. For people who are following after Ben Carson, they are very much in their own bubble. They're listening to the same kinds of newscasts, whether that's, you know, Breitbart or Fox News and all of this other stuff. They're listening to their pastors who, you know, may say this is just an attack from Satan against Ben Carson. So it's an echo chamber. And when you don't hear things outside the echo chamber and you've decided that your world is, you know, consistently under attack, it's easy for Ben Carson to lie. It's easy for him to sort of pull the wool over everybody's eyes. Now, what I think is going to happen this week, you know, with the debate and the ensuing weeks, is that these things will start to whittle away at him in Iowa. And those evangelical candidates, at least, you know, the evangelical people who are wanting to follow after him might start looking at Huckabee or Cruz or, you know, even Donald Trump and thinking that they could throw their vote to him if this continues. And I think it might.
And again, I'm speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her most recent book, Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. Professor Butler's latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. I'm trying to get a sense, though, of how, you know, you can be both a brain surgeon and believe in some really asinine conspiracy theories. And Dr. Carson did, when he was exploding and obviously getting very, very when you say in the coming weeks, things may get more intense. I'm not sure that he's not going to have a meltdown because he came close to it, I thought, in that press conference. But his defense in this agitated way was to accuse the press of giving President Obama or candidate Obama a free ride. And he listed, you know, the Bill Ayers and the Jeremiah Wright, and as if they were never investigated. I mean, they were investigated till the cows come home. And then the one that really is bizarre is he said, why haven't you, the press, looked into how Obama's records from Occidental College and somehow he ends up getting into Columbia University? Why were his records sealed? Why is it sealed? Why are you not interested in why his records are sealed? Well, that is a totally debunked conspiracy theory, and not to mention that the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act of 1974 is a federal law that protects the privacy of students' educational records. But it's complete fiction, and yet he clearly believes it. I don't think he's being cynical. I think he honestly believes that. And he took on Obama. That's how he became famous with the religious right at the prayer breakfast at the White House, where in front of the president, he basically castigated Obama and his policies, and that was shortly after Obama was reelected, and that's a lot of people cite that as the reason why he's become the darling of the religious right.
Yeah, absolutely. But to go to your question about whether or not, you know, how can you be a brain surgeon and believe all of these things, I think this, you know, deep sort of mindset about what's going on with him. I mean, on one hand, he believes he's called by God to do all of this, but then he can say whatever he wants. I mean, and I think the best thing I've seen this week that sort of says everything about what you want to know about Ben Carson, that in his house is a picture of a black Jesus with this black Jesus sort of laying hands on him from the back, standing behind him, to sort of give him the imprimatur of, you know, everything he does. And so I really do believe he thinks that whatever he says is going to go, whether it's a lie or not. And I, you know, you also have to think about who's his, you know, his campaign manager. We're talking about Armstrong Williams. This is a man who worked with a lot of different Republicans. Lee Atwater is one of his, you know, people that he really looked up to. And so if you think about the kind of campaigns that Lee Atwater run, and you turn that into what's going on with Ben Carson, it's pretty easy to see what's happening right now. And I think it's an important thing for everyone to remember that just because you lie, it doesn't mean that people won't believe you. And in a rational world, you would think that those lies are not going to work. But in an irrational world, or a world where irrationality doesn't really count, what counts is belief. What counts is, you know, solid, consistent belief, and, you know, a repetition of saying the same things over and over again. It just doesn't matter. And I think we're going to continue to hear these same things from him. I think you're right about the meltdown, but I think, you know, he doesn't go further in this presidential campaign because it's pretty clear that he's not professional. And the last thing I'd say is this, and I think this is really important. When he was asking all these questions on Friday about whether or not, you know, the media should be checking Obama, nobody said the most important thing of all, he's not running for president. You are. We're asking you. And I think it's part of the media's responsibility to push back on all these things. They don't really know how to push back against, you know, candidates who espouse religious beliefs. They don't know how to call them into account. And this is what I'd like to see change. I think that, you know, reporters and the media are going to have to get much more savvy, not you, but others, about what these religious, you know, statements really mean and how to interrogate them without feeling as though that they're impinging on people's religious beliefs.
Well, most certainly, some of the stuff that he said before these recent revelations, where he was, you know, essentially not being challenged on an interview with Charlie Rose, where he volunteered that he felt that there was a fifth column in the United States, and Charlie Rose pressed Dr. Carson on who do you mean? Who are these people that are trying to undermine American values and American democracy? And he finally said, well, the secular progressives. And then Charlie Rose says, well, who are they? Identify them. And he said, well, you know who they are. They're the secular progressives. And it sort of reminded me of Michelle Bachmann's talking about how there are communists among us, going back to McCarthy. That's pretty dangerous stuff. But the most scary thing of all was when he was asked about what he would do vis-a-vis what's happening now with Russia's intervention in Syria. And he said, I'd have a no-fly zone. And then Charlie Rose said, but the Russians have a no-fly zone. And wouldn't that mean that we'd you know, be sort of bumping up against them? And he said, well, you know, sure, you know, bring it on. And what do you mean? Well, it'll be a battle royale. That was his final statement. And he said, what would your statement be to Vladimir Putin? And Carson said, we're not going to back down. We're not going to back down. I mean, this was the most amateurish, reckless nonsense I've ever heard, let alone from a presidential candidate.
Yeah, exactly. And it's frightening, actually. But, you know, when you have apocalyptic visions of the end, or you think that you have an important place in history, or you believe that God's on your side, which, you know, I do believe that Dr. Carson really believes, then you can say all these things, and they sound crazy to people who are thinking, but to people who believe as he does, it's all fine. So I think what we have to sort of realize is that this is an alternate reality for a lot of people, and that alternate reality where they live in a religious world that God's going to take care of everything, and, you know, there's no common sense about war or how you deal with the Russians, or, you know, my favorite one was that he would just run up and go, you know, get that shooter and, you know, in Washington, and at the basically the school shooting that happened a month ago, where he said, you know, you just right. rush this guy, you just run at him, and it doesn't matter. That is very problematic. And you can't see, I cannot see that. Or, if, you know, all the things, if you put it together, what you said about the pyramids holding grain, all of these crazy kinds of statements, it's just embarrassing, quite frankly, to think about the, you know, importance of a presidential campaign, and we've got candidates like this who use the first year basically to set themselves up and have, you know, a great career afterwards on Fox News or selling books.
Well, do you think that the Republicans, the RNC, have, you know, I can't help feeling that Carson is their version of an African American, and Carly Fiorina is their version of a feminist, and that when Carson says in his book, Gifted Hands, that he protected white students from violent riots during the following Martin Luther King Jr.'s murder when he was at university in Detroit, which turned out there's no evidence of it, and none of the students remember it, and it doesn't look like it really happened, but it's certainly something that's music to the ears of white Republicans coming from their favorite African American.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to two things. One is the collapse of the Republican Party. And what I mean by that is this. The margins that they courted for all of these years, for 40 years, the religious right, you know, the Tea Party, all these people, they've become the center. And they don't have a party anymore. The kind of conservatives that were William Buckley or, you know, back in 64 with Goldwater, they don't have those people anymore. They've got a whole different brand of party now. And as a result, that makes for some tremendously terrible candidates for president. But what it does is it also makes some good candidates for them on the state level. And that's a whole other kind of conversation. So I think that they're not getting out of this. But I also think that, you know, the RNC is partially responsible in the ways in which they put together the debates and trying to do all this. And they made this a popularity contest instead of really hearing from candidates about what the real issues are. And no matter how much they fuss about the media, the fact remains is that we've had entertainment with Trump and, you know, Carson et al. We haven't had a true presidential candidate rise up from the ranks from them. And I think that if they continue to play to what used to be their margins but now is their center, they will continue to field candidates that are, you know, insufficient to the task.
Well, Anthea Butler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthea Butler, who is a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her most recent book is Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, which chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. Professor Butler's latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.